When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. We're recording on Thursday, January 28th, 2021. I'm Jeff O'Neill, joined today by Jen Northington. Rebecca's out. Jen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
I was thinking, was the last time you were on to talk about the Dune trailer 75 years ago?
Seriously, 1 million years ago. Yes, that is the last time I was on.
And yet Dune is still not out.
Didn't we got news about that, that now I can't remember. It's like, isn't it part of HBO Max's, like, you get them for 1 month kind of situation?
Sure. We're in, like, the Schrodinger's box office with movies right now. We don't know. I mean, the next big one, well, maybe we'll do a follow-up on that, because I think Dune fans, it might be worth talking about some other adaptation stuff that's going on. But it's been a while since you were on for a new show anyway, but it struck me as funny. It's like, what would the over-under, what was going to come first, Jen coming on again or Dune coming out? I think the odds for those were probably pretty divergent. They're our first real big news week of the year. Some of it is because Rebecca and I did the preview show last week, so some of the stories we would have talked about last week have gotten dropped into your guest lap, Jen. So we get to,
huzzah!
We get to wrestle with them. But before we dive into it, let's do a sponsor break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and, oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers, and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have seven great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number six. So if he is to have seven great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode.
On the update front, and you may know more about the inner workings of publishing than I do. I mean, I don't know at this point if you do or not, but like the imprint versus distributor thing is weird. And Rebecca and I think mentioned in passing last week that Josh Hawley was getting the stanky boot, I believe was the phrase we used from Simon Schuster. However, Regnery, which is a conservative imprint, distributed by Simon & Schuster, has now picked up the book, and Simon & Schuster will distribute it, which means, I guess, for a lay person-ish person. Wow, that was something. Does that mean Simon & Schuster has made a stand at all? I guess is the question sort of rolling around people's minds. Are they just robbing Peter to pay Paul morally, or are they? Is this really materially affect them? Or Jen, what do you think about this right now? What's your sense of what this means for, you know, Holly and Simon & Schuster, and really the change? Maybe the single biggest change we've seen over time is that publishers willing to do stuff like this to a sitting U.S. senator, not for nothing, is really interesting.
Yeah, so I guess we should say we're looking at a piece on The Guardian by Martin Pengelly. So publisher versus distributors and imprints. So it's an interesting relationship. My understanding, and this is how it was when I was a bookseller, is that it is very common for a big five publisher to agree to use their warehouse and sometimes like printing, but usually I think it's just warehouse distribution, on behalf of a much smaller imprint. So like, for example, Europa Press, right, who do great translated fiction, are distributed by Penguin, now Penguin Random House, because Europa doesn't have a network of warehouses across the country that can ship out books to bookstores and other distributors at the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. And, so they, I assume, have some kind of financial agreement with Penguin where Penguin like gets a cut or whatever of sales, you know, however that works out. So generally, that's the relationship between a big five publisher and a smaller press or imprint, is that, you know, the big five has agreed to use their warehouses and distribution channels on behalf of that smaller imprint. So, you know, legally, they are not responsible for the content of those books. And it's an interesting case in this situation, you know, that a Simon & Schuster press, imprint, whatever you want to call it, was going to publish this, dropped it, and then it got picked up by an imprint that is distributed but not owned by Simon & Schuster. So, yeah, like legally, yes, it is different. Mm-hmm. And I would think it would be potentially much more complicated for Simon & Schuster to refuse to distribute it than it would be to refuse to publish it, because they have, you know, clauses in their contracts with authors that allow them to do stuff like this, right? Like we've seen, you're right, we've seen more and more publishers willing to do this. When it comes down to the wire, and there's enough pushback against the publication of a book like this, but I don't know how much legal standing they have to refuse to distribute a particular book by a publisher that they have a distribution agreement for.
Yeah, I mean, so how much is plausible deniability? It's like, not our book. They're just throwing it on our truck, essentially, or something like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's the argument. Again, I don't know. I have no idea. Right. I could believe that it's much more complicated. I have no idea what those contracts look like. Do they have clauses for objectionable materials? Like, who knows what the wording is or how that works? I don't know. Well,
it's not unrelated, I don't think, to the idea of platform writ large, which is happening on all sorts of in all sorts of modes right now. Like various people getting removed from Twitter is a deplatforming, right? And how much is Simon & Schuster dropping Holly a deplatforming when he just can then get another imprint or another publisher using the same infrastructure, at least to some degree? Yeah. How much are we willing? How much are companies? How much employees of those companies? I think employees of companies in these situations are a force for this kind of change. That's maybe the single biggest difference is people at some of these places. Like I remember, you know, the Hachette walkout, I think it was against the Woody Allen book, right? It was a signal moment there. It's like, not only is it bad business, but it's like, we just don't want to do this. As the people who make this thing, we don't want to do this. Do they feel differently? You know, Simon & Schuster people thinking, I don't know. It's very tricky, it seems to me.
Yeah, it would mean that none of Simon & Schuster's employees would be working on the book, certainly. Like none of their editorial people involved, none of their publishing or marketing people are involved. Although potentially they could have a marketing agreement the imprints they distribute with. So that would be, that's a potential pain point right there. So, you know, it depends on, like what is it just we're putting it on the truck, or is it, yeah, we're doing marketing and publicity for this as well. We're grouping it in with our promotions. Right. Like there's all kinds of potential pain points for this that could potentially affect an employee of Simon & Schuster, rather than an employee of Regnery.
And not for nothing. I mean, I guess the biggest or the most sort of pillars of the earth moral case is this book is using our stuff to get into the world, right? I mean, that's whatever the agreement is. I think that's another thing people are trying to recalibrate is, okay, legal things aside, I understand. And maybe some of these slip through the crack. But in the future, does Simon & Schuster want to say, we have the right as part of our distribution agreement to say no bueno to a particular book? Because then they'd have to, essentially, they get all of the downside of being editorially responsible and none of the upside, because they have to basically authorize everything. So at what point, what are you doing there? It seems really tough. And I'm sympathetic to the problem. I'm not the kind of person saying Holly shouldn't be able to print his whatever on paper at home and hand it out in the corners. But as Rebecca and I've said here many times, you don't have a right to a publishing deal. I don't have a publishing deal. I'm not being silenced, that sort of thing. Right. But where is the accountability, I guess? And it feels like there's these walls that are becoming obviously less ethically water resistant to the different pieces of the business, and everyone's rethinking it. I can't imagine that Simon & Schuster was thrilled to see that Regnery is picking it up. They'd rather some other distributor, have this problem, right? I mean, I can't imagine they were thrilled to say, great, now we get neither the benefit, the PR benefit of dropping it, nor the financial benefit of just publishing it directly. So we get the worst of both worlds in this kind of situation as well. I would be curious to see if they rethink these distribution agreements going forward. Because presumably there was stuff they wouldn't distribute, right? There's got to be some...
Right.
You know,
I don't know. Yeah.
There must be some bottom to the barrel.
I would assume that they vet pretty specifically who they distribute for because they do know that now, especially in readers' eyes, readers don't know.
No,
you know, so they're going to be associated potentially with this. I do want to say this is sort of a side issue, but I have a bone to pick with how the coverage of this has been around conservative imprints because it seems to me that all of the press are using an extremely broad brush to say that, you know, is this the death of conservative imprint publishing? Is this, you know, do no conservatives ever get a book deal ever again? And I think it's important to point out that there is a difference between your like standard conservative Republican and Senator Hawley.
Mm-hmm.
I think it bears saying that, I mean, we have seen that there are divides in the Republican Party. There are people who are conservatives who don't identify as Republican and who maybe hold different beliefs. But I think it's extremely incorrect to just talk about conservative publishing as if it were all the same thing. This is just an issue I have with language. I think that's a bad, bad way to go, because it just denies us any ability to have nuanced conversations about this spectrum of what it means to be a conservative in the same way that there's a spectrum of what it means to be a progressive a centrist. Like, not everybody has the same beliefs. Not everybody is going to behave the way that Hawley behaved, as we have seen. Mm-hmm. So this is just an issue I have with a lack of nuance. Surprise! There's a lack of nuance on the internet.
Yeah, it's a great point, Jen, because the only time Regnery ever makes it onto this show is when we're talking about books like this in this sort of situation. So I don't know. Even within the Regnery catalog, is this to the right of where their midpoint is? Are the folks at Regnery, presumably who have made their piece either by affirmation or by sort of just participation with being part of a quote-unquote conservative press, are they like, I don't know about this Hawley book? Or like, yes, this is exactly the kind of thing we should be doing. I don't know enough about it. But I think that's a good point. Like, there's the hard far right, and then there's conservatives, and there's a whole bunch of things in between and betwixt and around both of those kinds of things. And I think it's interesting, too, that these relationships allow big publishers to have a finger in the pie without having culpability, responsibility, whatever else it might be. And I think that is something that is maybe at the center of what people, or my first reaction was like, well, it's just getting published by an imprint. How much money? Presumably some percentage of whatever books Holly sells goes back to Simon & Schuster. Frankly, at some level, that's all I care about. I don't care what the deal is. I care if the idea is this publisher doesn't want to be in the business of Joss Holly, and they're getting 50 cents per copy for letting it on the trucks and putting in their Edelweiss catalog and, you know, doing all the stuff that gets packaged together. I don't care. I frankly don't care what the deal is.
Yeah. And, you know, that's an opportunity for, like, as a, for example, something that they could do would be to say, yeah, we're donating any money we get to, you know, X cause, you know, to voter rights organizations, for example. You know, because, yes, you're right. Like, at the end of the day, they absolutely get some kind of money from distributing it, however small it might be. So, I think that's a fair point.
Yeah, it's again, I don't blame them for being in a tough spot because we're in a different world and some of the rules and agreements may have force of, you know, it might be unreasonable right now for Simon & Schuster to say, we're not even going to let you distribute this.
Right.
You know, but that doesn't mean you get out of jail forever for having done something crappy or something you don't agree with. Or just own it. Say, you know what? In some way, I respect that a little bit differently, saying it's not our book, but we have this relationship. We think it's important that these presses exist. And while we don't authorize everything they do, these presses have a place in the marketplace and blah, blah, blah. And then take your lumps and move on. You know, I guess that would be the other way of doing it. This will now become PRH's problem, right? Because Simon Schuster is presumably at some point in the near future going to add to the burgeoning acronym.
I mean, PRH and Hachette all distribute. I was just thinking about, you mean like distribution wise, like surely another book will come up where this is an issue. But you're right. It's true. PRH is trying to buy Simon & Schuster. So, gosh. Anyway, it's a tangled web.
It really is. And again, some of this, I think, again, like you say, there's not a lot of room for nuance. When Simon & Schuster struck this deal, presumably it was before Holly was inciting a riot against the Capitol.
Yeah.
Like, there is some leeway to be given. When, you know, new facts enter into the world. But this is the business you've chosen, to quote Hyman Roth in The Godfather, and this is the world in which you you live. So you got to react to it as best you can. I do wonder if, let's say, what number of dollars does Regnery's deal contribute to Simon & Schuster's bottom line? At what point is it worth it just to do it? Like, just say, you know what, I don't want to do this. Like, you might... PRH-SNS may have a antitrust problem, actually, when it comes to stuff like this.
Yeah, I think they do, in fact, but that's another conversation.
You know, and that's the kind of thing that the big platforms are going to run into and already running into now. It's like, it's not a free speech problem necessarily, but an antitrust problem is probably more, I'm more sympathetic to that argument than the free speech one. Or at least I'm more interested. I don't know if I'm sympathetic to it, but it makes sense. Like, if you have the whole market, I can't compete, and you've squashed out competition. That's the other side of these kinds of arguments.
Yeah, I mean, on the flip side, you know, we see authors who are like genuinely marginalized making it work with self-publishing or, you know, alternative options to traditional publishing. So I think that it is harder in a lot of ways, but also, you know, they are, some of them will never go to traditional publishing because they're making so much more money the way they're doing it now. So like, I don't think it's realistic to say that either you get a, you know, a publishing contract or your words are never seen, because we know for a fact that that's not true. That's not how the market works. However, absolutely, there are antitrust issues. That doesn't mean that it's easy or that it should not be easier than it is right now.
I guess I was more thinking of the antitrust pieces. Rebecca and I were talking about how basically all the book printers in the U.S. are bankrupt or soon to be bankrupt, right? And like there's a contracting bandwidth to print books, like literally hard to print books. It has been. And PRH has been, you know, they're building out their own. I mean, for an internal company thing, we were talking about book distributors and like Ingram and Baker and Taylor, and then PRH has its own warehouses. Like, that's how big PRH is right now. Like, they kind of compete at that level. And as they consolidate more, not only get the distribution bandwidth, but they if PRH wanted to, they could corner the market on book printing in America pretty easily by buying a couple right. things. And at that point, because then it's not about what's in the books, it's the ability to print yes. books at all.
Yes, absolutely.
Because I think you're right. I think as much as there are very, very serious antitrust issues around Amazon, it's hard to look at the data. I mean, it came out in January that print sales were up 22% over last year in January.
Yeah.
Book sales are up. People sell books and audiobooks and print books from a buyer's, and as you say, self-published authors or independent presses point of view. It's easier to get books in front of people than other, maybe not print books, but you know, if you widen the circle. But if you're actually if you're in the business of trying to print on dead trees and get them into bookstores, it's kind of harder than ever to do it that way as well. And how this fits into that is really interesting. So that's more follow-up than I thought we did, but I'm glad you were here for this because you have had more direct experience of like this mishigas of dealing with it, distributors versus imprints versus publishing houses, which is difficult even for someone like me that kind of does this day in and day out to keep straight. And every deal is different. I guess that's what we're saying. We don't know what the nature of it. There's so many bespoke deals between imprints and publishers, let alone between imprints within sub imprints, you know, all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mess. The confederation of how publishing works. Again, I don't know a lot of industries. The only one I can think of that may be relevant is Michelle and I were watching some movie the other night. I'm sure people out there have noticed this too. The fragmentation of the production company logo. Like, I've got to sit through 12 production company logos right now to watch a movie.
Right.
And I think it's kind of a similar thing where there's so many fingers and so many different pies. Who is actually responsible and who's what is usefully vague for the producer sometimes. Because you can pass the proverbial buck around and say, oh, I'm just a partner. I'm just a distributor. I'm whatever. So there's that. Holly continues to be there. Off the top of your head, is it Post Hill Press? That's like, what's the next biggest, you know, quote unquote conservative press? Do you know off the top of your head, Jen?
I feel like Sentinel is one I know off the top of my head, but I actually, honestly, in terms of like relative market share, I have absolutely no idea.
No, I don't either.
So, I mean, my knowledge of imprints that are like fiction, which is mostly what I deal with, is limited at best. So when you get into, you know, especially nonfiction and then, you know, breaking it down into like conservative versus progressive versus centrist, I have very little idea. But it turns out I can name one.
Yeah. and Regnery is the other, right? It's Regnery
one.
And Sentinel.
Yeah, right.
I think Post Hill I see from time to time, which maybe even, again, it could be availability bias that
I only
notice.
Well, Skyhorse, right? Are they the ones?
Yeah, that's right.
Woody Allen.
They didn't always used to be, though, right? I mean,
but they're not a conservative imprint. They are an imprint that will print about anything.
that's right.
Is really what's true about Skyhorse.
They don't care what kind of pie it is. They'll put their finger in it.
Yeah. If they think it's going to sell, they'll print it.
That's right.
And that's, you know, a different kind of.
In a way, at least I can understand that. You know, and respect is not the right word, but it's clearer to me why would I do something else like that. You know, I don't know if it made it onto the show or not, and I don't know actually going to be a thing or not, but there was a story floating around about Fox News having its own imprint somewhere.
Yes, I do remember seeing that.
Which, again, is not something I would like to see in the world. From a business point of view, I can understand why they would do it.
Right.
They could, I mean, if you're Hawley and Simon & Schuster drops you and there's Fox News out there that'll publish your book, wouldn't be that the one that would pick you up in that regard?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, that was enough. We better do another sponsor break because we got like three more huge stories to get into before we get moving. All right, let's do a sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by W.W. Norton & Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Jillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties, in low threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Jillian Linden. And thanks again to WW Norton & Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild at heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult slash crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon-worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode.
All right, Jen, you pick next in our buffet of interesting book news stories.
Goodness. I want to talk about Amanda Gorman.
I think we have to. I'm so glad you picked that next.
I was watching the ceremonies. I should say I watched the swearing-in ceremony. Mm-hmm. I did not watch Celebrate America. So
tough hang, Celebrate America. I can tell you from having watched it. Tough
was
hang.
Was it?
Tough hang.
I don't want to be in front of my TV for that long. Yeah. I saw Lady Gaga, I saw J-Lo, I saw Garth Brooks, and I saw Amanda Gorman.
The poo-poo platter for Amanda Gorman, Lady Gaga, Garth Brooks, and J-Lo didn't know. They were merely the amuse-bouches to the main course that was Amanda Gorman.
Absolutely true. So the piece we're looking at this time is from The Wrap, reported by J. Clara Chan. And it is that she's 22 years old. She's the first youth poet laureate. And she performed a poem at the Biden-Harris inauguration. It was amazing. I was watching it with my partner, and I said, you know, you can tell she's from the slam scene.
Yes.
Like, I have a passing familiarity with the slam scene, and it was so nice to see that represented on that level of stage. And she was incredible. And you know, the response has been enormous, right? Her books are number one and number two on Amazon after a
day. And they're not out.
This is the crazy part.
Go,
so she's got two books coming out. One is called Change Sings, which is a children's book. And the second is The Hill We Climb Poems, The Hill We Climb is the poem that she performed at the inauguration. Mm-hmm. And I just saw this morning. There was a tweet that says, Penguin announces 1 million copies, first printings, for Amanda Gorman's books, which is a huge, that is a huge number of books. And The Hill We Climb is being rushed. It was originally supposed to come out for September, but they're pushing it to March.
Yep.
So, you know, it's gotten bumped up by like 6 months. That's a huge amount of money on behalf of the publisher to invest in a 22-year-old poet. And I just could not be more delighted to see all of it.
Can we back up just for a second, Jen?
Of course.
To the actual, I had the experience while watching it. And I'm assuming now seeing these trailing indicators that most people who were interested did too, of in the moment thinking and feeling like, oh, this is a thing. This is a moment. I remember thinking, and I have some, but probably even less than you do in spoken word and slam poetry. But the cadences, hand gestures, were a different mode than you're used to seeing. Because of late, I mean, it was a big deal when Maya Angelou or Rita Dove was the inaugural poet. But this is even different than that, because Maya Angelou and Rita Dove in their performance and demeanor fall more in sort of like a, you know, it's almost easier to draw a line between Robert Frost at Kennedy's inauguration and Rita Dove than Rita Dove to Amanda Gorman in terms of style and substance, right? That they're both
Absolutely.
Black women is important, but stylistically quite a bit different than Rita Dove would have performed. And I got choked up, got tears in my eyes, looked over at Michelle, same situation. My kids were completely transfixed. Mm. She's not only 22, but she looks like she's 14. It's because she's, yeah. I mean,
she does have a young face.
I didn't know how old she was. So when they said youth poet laureate, I was like, is she 14? She could, if you would have told me she was 14, I was like, oh, I would have believed that. Roy Blount messed up the intro saying our first poet laureate. I was like, oh, Roy,
yes.
tough yeah. hang for our boy, Roy Blount there. So that was fantastic. I haven't done much of the, I need the TikTok of how she got this gig. Like who was the talent scout, or like, how did this happen to have her to do this at all? And I think, and I haven't gone back to check this, historically, inaugural poets happen earlier in the swearing in. And I wonder if they knew that ain't no one want to follow Amanda Gorman, except for the benediction. Literally the thing we have to do last. Because if you're Garth, you don't want to follow that. Lady Gaga didn't want to follow that. Ain't no one want to. Biden and Kamala didn't want to follow that. So interesting, she got this the cleanup spot, second to last there at the end. Fascinating to see. I mean, you know, maybe in a future episode, we'll do a close reading of the poem itself, because it's something we've liked to done recently. I had a good response to that. I need a little more time, I think, to look at it. But then from there, because then, you know, Michelle and I then did the thing that everyone did, it sounds like, which is go on and see, let's go get the book. Let's go get the thing, the poem. And I believe in years past, the inaugural poet poem was available generally quicker. Like usually it was ready to go pretty quick. And so when we saw that it wasn't available, and then her next book wasn't available for a billion years either, I was like, who was asleep at the wheel at the publishers? Right. Like literally, I mean, is that fair, Jen? Like why isn't, did they not know? They clearly didn't know. Like 6 months later to get the poem out, they just didn't know that it was going to become a thing, I guess.
So I don't have a specific timeline for this, but what I do know is that, you know, as I'm clicking around and seeing all these stories about her come up, I saw one where she is looking very glamorous with lots of other celebrities at an event in November of this past year, which is obviously clearly precedes. So like her, this is not, you know, she was already a thing in certain circles.
She didn't get plucked out of a high school in Sheboygan or something like that. Right. Yeah.
Right. She's a college student. She's clearly been
Harvard
doing this. Yeah, she's a Harvard student. She's been doing this for a while. Like, and she has made a name for herself enough to get her on whatever radar she needed to be on to be tapped as an inaugural poet. But yeah, if I'm her publisher, which she clearly already had the book deal, right? Yeah. Like those book deals did not happen post ceremony. I would definitely have been trying to rush something because, you know, like even if she hadn't been as amazingly good as she was, you're going to get interest, right? Like it's sort of like it almost doesn't matter how the performance is. I mean, it does, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
oh, but for a poetry book, for any, if she was terrible, people would have bought the book just to have it because it was a Biden thing. Yeah,
right. Exactly. But, and then on top of it, it's not like they don't already know that she's good. Like, this is not a one-off thing. You know, she got here for a reason. So I do think I am really curious as to who was at that wheel and what the decision making was there, because it does seem like a pretty big oversight not to have something, maybe not the whole thing, but something.
Because she said that she wasn't done. She finished the poem she performed like after the riot and was influenced by the riot. And that's, print on demand has come a long way, Jen, but you know, we're still not there yet.
Sure.
But to have her other poems ready to go wouldn't have been insane thing to think of. It wouldn't have been outside the realm of possibility to say she's going to be there. What do we have that's ready to go so that people could go online or into their, well, people don't go into bookstores right now exactly, or not very often, but like that we have something to, you know, capitalize for her and for us, and frankly, for the moment to have available.
100%.
Like, isn't what publishing is supposed to do to some degree?
Yeah.
So that 100%. Was a frustration. I'm glad to see it get bumped up, but it is too bad that we couldn't have it quicker and have more of a moment around it. Because even March is going to feel like a long time. And anyway, so in addition to this, she's got two books. They're both 1 and 2. 1 million print run, you mentioned before. Rebecca and I, as we said last week, we were agog at Kristen Hanna's print run for her next book being 1.5. Right, like that's the upper end of what you're going to get. And for it, basically someone who went from no one had ever heard of her, no one, you know, I mean, I'm rounding to within a first approximation here. Very few people had heard of her, to 1 million print run coming out in April, I'm having a hard time of thinking of anything like it in publishing, where you go from the day before your publisher didn't have a book out for you to the next day your books being number one and two. I can't think of an equivalent, Jen. You've been in the book selling business longer than I have and paying attention to it. Is there anything even where close in terms of the hockey, like straight vertical interest, if you're graphing it, right? Like, screw GameStop. I want to be in the Amanda Gorman stock buying business right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fascinating, and she's got a modeling contract. I mean,
yep.
I don't know what to say except she looked great. I mean, I can see why she looked amazing. Her outfit was amazing. She's a beautiful young woman and she's a young person. Like, I can see why people were drawn to her, and I don't know how to factor that in the conversation. I don't think, if anything, probably it detracts from the quality of the poetry because people are struck by just what she looks like, frankly. I don't know if that's a factor at all. And I guess one of the reasons I was a little bit sad not to have the poetry ready to go, you know, I'm a text person, so I want the text in front of me. I like the performance too, but I want the text in front of me. But as a cultural figure, this isn't a publishing story, I guess, what I'm trying to get. This is a cultural figure story.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it means for her. I can't think of a poet with this kind of profile now who's like part model, part politician. She says in one interview I read with her that she wants to be president someday.
Right.
So she has overt, long-term political thinking. I don't know, Jen. She seems to me a one of one at this moment in my memory of how these things go.
Yeah, I mean, there have been certainly poets who have exploded in popularity over the past years thanks to the internet. Like, I'm thinking of Rupi Kaur, for example, as an, you know, like who, but I don't think, it wasn't overnight. Like, it was maybe over the course of a couple of weeks or a couple of months, you know.
It's like more viral, right? Well, this isn't viral. Yeah. This is like, it's a thing. Like, it's just,
I
don't even know how to describe
it. So I do think it's a pretty singular event. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what else to say right now. I mean,
pre-order the book is what I want to tell everybody.
Yeah, I mean, if you can get it, right? This is going to go, I mean, it hits all the quadrants for book buying in a lot of ways, right? There's a lot of pent-up demand right now for, frankly, a celebration of liberalism. And I'm using capital L or lowercase L liberalism, not that you're a liberal, but like liberal democracy as a thing people who cared about. It's a celebration. It was much more, it was both celebratory and a recognition of pain and problem, right? And it's new. It wasn't just America the Beautiful. You know, it wasn't just a cover of something else. For a lot of people who are interested in books and don't know spoken word or know slam or other kinds of performed poetry come out of that genre, it has the same sort of feel, shock of the new, that, you know, probably striking a lot of the same nerves in woke white people like me that seeing Hamilton for the first time struck in them as
right?
Like, of having a first encounter with a mature but underknown, relatively speaking, art form, and seeing a full expression of it in a particular context, and then everything else going around. It's kids. It's a kid. There's kids' books. It's approachable.
Right.
People are going to want it for the historical moment. This is going to go to every public library in America. It's going to go in every school library in America. It's hard to tick more boxes, I don't think. In this particular, really exciting. I was moved and surprised by poetry in a way that I haven't been in a long time. And it was thrilling. It was absolutely thrilling for a ceremony that was so strange for so many reasons and muted. And I think understandably so. Unfortunately, you know, Kamala especially didn't get the triumphal Inauguration Day stuff that we would have liked to have seen. But when Amanda Gorman comes out in the bright yellow coat, I'm bad at fashion, so I'll leave it at coat. I'm sure people, it's a more, and then, you know, this bright red headpiece, and she's smiling, and she's using her hands, but she's also somber. Like, that twinning of the somberness and the hopefulness was so felt like right on the nerve of where so many people who were invested in the inauguration were, that I think there was something to, I'm trying not to undersell the message that was within the performance and the spectacle of it. There was a piece of it that wasn't just consuming it. Like, it really spoke to something. The line that seems to be going around the most memeable lines, which would, you know, in the old days I would have written a book where I posted the 10 most memeable lines from Amanda Gorman.
Right.
But the ones like, you know, there's always light if you only can see it, if only you can be it, I think struck a lot of people. and a variation of Morrison's, you know, write the book you want to see in the world, a variation of Gandhi's, I think, be the change you want to see in the world. So it's related to prior ideas, but with enough of a spin that it felt new again. Really exciting. It can be hard to have a more exciting book-related literature, reading-related moment in the year. And technically, this is 2021, but inauguration was New Year's Day 2021, as far as I was concerned. So I'm wrapping it in there. Going from being surprised to going to my wheelhouse, ebook prices are back in the news. Jennifer Northington, and let me just say, welcome to my house world. It's time to have this conversation again. I've been talking about this really since the show began, but really especially since the first of these lawsuits. It's really who's colluding with whom is the ongoing carousel of ebooks. And the reason it is something we referred to before, and you and I definitely have different opinions on Amazon, but where I am come down on Amazon is with ebooks, they absolutely are a monopoly. They do 90% of ebooks. And multiple collusion lawsuits that are legitimate, that regular people can understand, like most of these antitrust stuff, it's like about buying lithium from, you know, someplace in Africa, like these antitrust things you don't really understand very well. But this is like, I've been talking about, I mean, I don't want to congratulate myself because I'm bad, but I'm saying I've been talking about this for years about how ebook prices make absolutely zero sense and there's absolutely no competition for ebook pricing because of it all happens in one place. And publishers can keep the prices high because there's no discounting. And Amazon is interested in keeping them just high enough, but also just low enough to serve their industry and competitive needs. And the other thing that's really hard, I think, is that, you know, one thing that I just bought today. What did I just buy today? Something from Book Riot Deals. Like yesterday I bought Ninth House by Leigh Bardugo for $3 from Amazon. Okay, how can that be true? But all front lists are all $14.99. Like literally every front list book is $14.99 for ebook. So on January 14th is Publishers Weekly, a piece by Andrew Albanese. This was all over the place too. So you can find it in the very different places. The same law firm that successfully sued Apple and five major publishers for colluding to fix ebook prices in 2011. So that was just as Book Riot was getting started. So the podcast hadn't even started. So I didn't get to rail about that. I didn't get to gloat about that there. Now I get to go down like the MC of the Mardi Gras parade. accusing the company of colluding with Big Five publishers to restrain price competition in the ebook market. Filed in New York, the Southern District of New York, which is the most sympathetic district to antitrust legislation. There's a reason that these mostly get served there. Names not only Amazon as a defendant, which I think is interesting, but the Big Five are all there as co-conspirators.
Do you know what that means in like non-lawyer? I sort of wish we had asked our resident in-house lawyer, former lawyer about this, because like what I'm wondering is, okay, so if only Amazon is a defendant, then are they the only ones who bear the consequences? Or like, does the suit then impact what publishers can and cannot do going forward?
Right.
I just like who does this stick to, I guess?
I don't
both
know,
both financially,
Jen,
and legally.
I think
that's
a great
that's
point.
One of my questions.
We'll do some more. I'll do some more homework as this develops. And I think there'll be more as things get, you know, brought into the light about this. But I don't take the phrase co-conspirator lightly. I feel like that's something that has not only sort of a cultural impact, but it feels like it has a legal gravity as well. So I wouldn't be surprised. Consequences there. Seems to revolve around a most favored nations clause to squelch consumer price competition and keep ebook prices artificially high. I think it's really interesting. I mean, whatever you think about, I know less about antitrust law than I probably could. I think it's fascinating that this was filed on January 14th. Because the last administration, I think, was very uninterested in prosecuting antitrust violations.
Right.
I think the current administration is probably more interested. And also writ large, not for nothing, no one right now feels great about big tech, right? Everyone is interested in like, do they really need to be up there so high in terms of power and prestige and profit, right? Is this really reasonable right now? So I think there's a sense in which public sentiment is like, yeah, I would bet most people would say, yeah, Amazon probably has too much power, right? In a survey, most people would probably understand that. People still like to use them. I still like to use them. But I don't think it makes any sense that ebook prices are always $14.99. It just doesn't make any sense to me. The other thing that's happened interesting, and I wonder how this connects to something I've talked about on the show before, and I got some follow-up from listeners. Thank you very much. I'm not going to do it directly. Also kind of backing up my observation that the discounting of print books on Amazon is almost gone. I mean, it's a completely different world. Now, the AAA, I'm sure Amanda Gorman's book will have be a 40% discount when it comes out because it keeps the things that would be on the front table of Costco at a 40% discount. But like number 8 and me and my and Rebecca draft picks are going to be maybe 10% off right now. Yeah. So then in the old days, the thing I was railing against is how the ebooks were $14.99 and the hardcover was $15.99 or something like that. It's like, how does that make sense for an ebooks situation? That clearly tells you that something is out of whack, because I know it's, you still got to pay and you still got to edit, but you can't tell me that it costs a dollar more to print and ship a hardcover than it is to deliver an ebook. I've looked at the math. It doesn't work. Like, it's way cheaper to do an ebook. But interesting, rather than being ebook prices down to reflect the premium that they get for an ebook versus shipping and printing, especially now, frankly, a hardcover, what they've done is floated the print prices up, right? They didn't bring ebooks down. They floated up because, you know what? That's more money to Amazon. Whereas bringing ebook prices down is less money to publishers and Amazon. So again, I don't know the law. They're probably gonna have to find some sort of smoking napkin where someone wrote down, hey, let's collude at some restaurant somewhere. I don't know what the burden of proof is, but based on the pricing strategy we've seen of late, the pieces fit together with me that there is some sort of coordinated wink wink nod nod even agreement that we're going to keep ebook prices where we are and let the discount on print float up, and there's more money for us who make books writ large. Jen, what do you think of that theory? Does that make sense to you? What do you add to this?
Well, I think it's important to note here that publishers have not changed the price of hardcover or print books.
Amazon
has changed the price. And Amazon has been selling print books at a loss since they started. Mm-hmm. That was a very deliberate strategy. It's like documented as a business strategy, as a loss leader. You can look it up. Loss leaders anchor consumers understanding that they're getting a better deal and then pave the way for you to buy other items at it potentially inflated or certainly non-discounted prices and still feel like you're getting a bargain. So they lure you in with the cheaper thing and then they get the money for the more expensive thing. And books were their cheaper thing, which makes sense, right? They're super easy to optimize for. And while publishers print, you know, prices on the book, like it literally says how much the book costs on the cover, but you can charge whatever you want. Now, because an ebook is a digital good and the rules around that are so wibbly wobbly and still in development, you know, publishers were able to say, like, this is how much ebooks cost, right? That was that first lawsuit. And then, you know, again, like in Amazon's interest, like they've been losing money on books for decades. So what incentive do they have to downprice the ebooks?
None.
Almost none.
None.
Almost none. None. So, and because they're not warehousing anything, they're just paying for, I don't know, whatever the license distribution fees
are. Yeah, the DRM, the digital rights management.
Yeah, exactly. The DRM and then the, you know, the cost from the publisher, whatever the publisher price is for those. Like, there's no incentive for them to downprice it. So, like, am I surprised? 0%. Like, it was only a matter of time before Amazon captured enough of the market share through loss leading that then they didn't have to do it anymore.
Yeah.
Like, loss leading isn't a permanent strategy. It's as long as it takes to get as much market share as you're going for, and then you don't have to do it anymore because it's convenient, it's familiar, people are used to it, they have their own shipping arms, so now you can get a book from Amazon in like a tenth of the time that it takes to get a book from anywhere else, right? Because the U.S. Postal Service is extremely
defunded, underfunded.
Yeah, defunded, underfunded, like in crisis at the moment. So, you know, I honestly don't know what to say about it other than I will be very curious to see what arguments are made in favor of fixed ebook pricing because, you know, I've seen the math as well. Like, it's it's weird math, right? Yes. But ebooks are not that much cheaper to produce than print books. It's just that people have accepted a different kind of price structure for physical goods versus digital goods. And so, you know, the perception of value is very different in the consumer. And that's why a hardcover costs $32 and a paperback costs, you know, $16.99, when in fact it costs like there's like a dollar difference in terms of materials to produce a hardcover versus a paperback. Like, that's just true.
Yep.
And, you know, so again, like, margins are such a mystifying thing to me. You know, like, the markup in books is some of the smallest margins in retail. You know, if you buy an article of clothing, that markup is like in the hundreds to thousands of percents, whereas a book is like, you know, 40 to 60% margin.
Which, if you come to it cold, that feels like a good margin, right? I think that's context is helpful, what you said about clothes or some other things. Clothes, I mean, not for nothing, using extremely cheap labor from globalization to make coats, then you charge $200 for because you have brand name on it, is a huge margin. And some of the brand, some of that brand stuff just doesn't work in publishing, right? Because no one cares what the imprint is. It's just true. And weirdly, even books that people do care, like, again, I'm so interested in all of it, but like, publishers also then don't charge more for their premium brands in terms of like the authors.
Yes.
Like, the Gorman book is not going to be $49.99.
No. Right.
It could, in different situations, you would pay more to get the Gucci bag versus the regular bag. But in books and reading, it doesn't work that way for reasons I think I understand, but makes for weird incentives all over the place. So I'm looking right now at The Prophets by Robert Jones Jr., debut novel. I'm going to read it. It's next on my list, but I haven't bought it, right? Came out in January. Number one new release in Black and African American historical fiction on Amazon. Jen, I would like for you to guess right now. I'm sorry. This is something I do to Rebecca.
That's fine.
But you're playing Rebecca today, so you have to take this. I'm so sorry, and also not
sorry
at all.
It's fine.
The list price, you know, this is what you're going to pay at your local indie, is $27.
Right.
Okay. What do you guess? This is U.S. I'm signed in as myself. I'm a Prime member. I buy literary fiction. I don't know how if there's any variance by this is asterisk. I don't know if they do any stuff like this, have changed the price based on your buying patterns for this stuff. So that's a thing I've always wondered, but I can't be anyone other than myself legally at this point, at least. So what do you think the hardcover price is right now for it's a debut lit fic, and this is Big Five. So let me get you the imprint. I think this is one. Is this One World? Oh boy, I gotta do all the blurbs. Putnam.
I mean, I've been looking at this too. I've not seen much discounting for titles like this, so I'm gonna guess like $25.
$23.99. It's an 11% discount. Can you do you know you do audiobook, you do ebooks from Kobo, and that's the other place I want to bring this in here. What would you expect to pay on Kobo for this kind of a book?
Yeah, I mean, I think generally like $14 to $16.99.
$14.99 on Kindle.
Yep. Yeah.
So that's the piece that I that's not mentioned here that I think it's interesting that you happen to be on today, because I do my audiobooks from Libby and from Amazon, and you do from your library. Do you use Libby as well?
Yes.
And Kobo.
I do. I use Libby. I use Hoopla. Yep. And I use Kobo.
Kobo.
Yep.
It's so weird to me that the Kindle the ebook prices are basically the same on Apple, on Google, on Kobo, and on Amazon. Isn't that interesting?
Well, and not only that, if there's a down price on Amazon, it usually means there's a down price on Kobo. So like, for example, when I see something show up in the Book Riot Daily Deals, I don't click that link because I'm not going to buy it from Amazon. Mm-hmm. But if I go to Kobo, nine times out of ten, I have the same or a close, like maybe it's $3.99 instead of $1.99. But generally speaking, it's also down priced on the Kobo site. So like, I'm not paying any more for ebooks. What I'm not getting are all of those Amazon exclusives, you know, their 99-cent, like whatever internal publishing. I can't get those.
They're Dean Koontz or, you know, whatever
else is out. Right. You know, yeah. So I don't have access to those, but otherwise, if it's, you know, a traditionally published ebook, generally the pricing, it matches.
What do you think the best-selling fiction? I'm trying to think of something. What's discounted 40% right now, would you guess? Like, what's the
God, I'm so like
Here we go. I came up with one. It looks good. So Outlawed by Anna North. I think this is a literary nerd pick right now. It was a Reese's Book Club pick, but it was making some preview lists on like the millions of stuff before.
Right.
List price of $26. Any guesses about what the sticker price is?
I'm going to bet you that it is around $15.
Yeah, $16.35. Right.
Yeah, and but I will bet you that's a Reese Witherspoon.
It is.
I would not expect that book to, if Reese Witherspoon had not picked it and it was still buzzy in the fiction world, I will bet you it would not be that.
I think that's you're right on the nose here, is that it's kind of, I think it's been hidden to most average buyers of books, right? Because someone buying Anna North is not an average person, but they might represent the midpoint of a book buyer. They're going to read a fiction book, but they might need it to be in a book club or their friend talked about it. They're not like you and I or book riot people who are like, you know, like scouting for books that are coming down and reading the Edelweiss blurb coming down the way. Those still, and then if something makes the bestseller list by dint of word of mouth or something else like that, then it'll go there. So, yeah, I just, but the Kindle stuff then isn't discounted. So it doesn't float with the other discounting, which is a pretty good indication to me that the price is being manipulated. Because if you're discounting the hardcover and the Kindle thing's always the same, except if it goes to $2.99 when it's been out for 2 years, and that price is the same on every other digital platform, it just so happened that everyone rolled hard eights on the dice all the time. That makes no sense.
My understanding is that fixed ebook pricing is a feature, not a bug.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Isn't it agency pricing? It's like that's the whole point of it.
Yes.
And I think what this lawsuit is doing is contesting the legality of that.
Right.
Like they're saying, like, no, this isn't just a business practice. This is collusion, and it's, you know, a most favored nation issue and all of this other stuff. But yeah, my understanding is that, like, again, it's not by chance. It's that way deliberately.
Right.
And everybody has agreed to this because that's what you have to agree to if you want to sell the ebook.
That's right. So, and the anti-competitive bit is a little bit hard to see, but I think, and tell me if this thought experiment makes sense to you, Jen. Say Book Riot wanted to open its own ebook store, right, where you could buy ebooks through us and it would be on your little Book Riot app. But we wanted to do the same thing Amazon did to print books to get started, which is we'll loss lead on ebooks to get people to use our platform. So we're going to have The Survivors by Jane Harper, which is the number one pick in my draft that a lot of people mentioned in their few too many votes for me versus Rebecca, I should say, in our draft last week, right? And they want to buy it. And we said, you know what? We don't need to make, we just want to, we don't even want to, we won't even take a loss. We just want to break even on the sale of the ebook. I don't think right now Flatiron would let us sell it for $9.99 or whatever, right? We couldn't even do that. Because of these most favored nations, and they wouldn't give us the right and blah, blah, blah. That's basically what you're saying, right, Jen?
Yeah, the pricing, the down pricing happens on the publisher side. So if a book is $1.99, $2.99, whatever, it's because the publisher has reset the price for a limited amount of time. Maybe they did it in collaboration with Amazon based on what's selling, what's popular, blah, blah, blah. But like they're the ones who say, okay, now this book is this price. And that's why it's across the board. That's why it shows up on Kobo. That's why it's the same. So, you know, it's a feature. It's an agreed upon business practice that ebook prices are fixed.
That's right. And if you, I'm looking at the Jane Harper, The Survivals, which comes out next week too. Still haven't decided what format, blah, blah, blah. If you look at the hardcover right now, 30% discount. So, you know, this is a global franchise, Jane Harper at this point. You know, it already has 5,000 ratings from around the world. The hardcover is $19.59 on a $28 list price, so it's a 30% haircut. The Kindle is $14.99. The other thing, if you buy ebooks at all, and I don't know if Google and Apple do this, but if you click on the Kindle and look at the little, you know, pre-order price $14.99, and right under it says sold by Macmillan, and then in italics below it says price set by seller, right?
Yeah. Yep.
If you look at the hardcover, it does not say that. So the canary there is that it's set by Amazon. So I don't know. So clearly the lawsuit then that names Amazon particularly, even though Amazon is trying to say, we didn't set this price, don't blame us for high book ebook prices. The lawsuit is basically saying, well, the thing is you have 90% of the market. You could use your market position to lower Kindle prices. Amazon could. You know why I know that? Because they're already doing with hardcover prices.
Right.
So anyway.
Yeah, although I guess the argument could be that, like, at the point that agency pricing came into effect, there could have been collusion with Amazon at that point.
Yes.
You know, like, right. in the, like, it's not a chicken issue, it's an egg issue.
Mm-hmm.
That could be. Jeff, do we need to do another sponsor? I'm just looking at my timer.
Yes,
right
we
here.
Do need to do one more sponsor, and we've got, like, one more story to do, but we got to do our last sponsor and then get out of here.
Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Luis can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric, and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's Hero Quest at your local bookstore or online at herquest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. Hero Quest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hero to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hero's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's Hero Quest at your local bookstore or online at herquest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
Here. Let's say that's it. We're going to follow the story, clearly. You have feelings about the Sparrow adaptation that Rebecca mentioned briefly. I don't know where you fall on the Sparrow spectrum. Well, is this a beloved text? Are you anxious about this? You tend to be okay on the whole with adaptations of books you like, so I wouldn't imagine it's sort of a prior against adaptations. Talk to me about your take on the Sparrow being adapted writ large, and also the particulars that you've learned about here.
Yeah, so this is an interesting one because, you know, this book was written a while ago.
Yes.
Let's say that for a start. Yeah, published in 1996. So this book is college age? Is that right? No, it's like post-college. It's like
yeah.
30s now.
Depends on how old you are, Jen.
Yeah, 30s. So anyway, right. So so this book has been out for a while. And I just want to say, like, I read it, you know, in, I want to say, the early aughts. And it kind of blew my mind. Like, it was unlike anything else I had read at that point. And I have actually been afraid to revisit it.
Yes.
Because I feel confident that there are things in there that I would now find less appealing as a reader. And, like, I think, you know, potentially there's some issues around, like, racial depictions and, you know,
speciesism, like, and otherness,
sexuality,
maybe.
And yeah. Like, so yeah, so there's a lot of, like, potential weird stuff in there. So that informs my then, like, trepidations/interest in an adaptation, because what I think happens so often with these things is this is a chance to update that
yes.
stuff.
Yes.
Right? Like, this is a chance to sort of bring a director and a showrunner and a show writer's sensibilities to material that perhaps is now dated or, you know, could use some updating in various ways. However, you have to trust the team that's doing the updating to do a good job on that, which isn't always true. And you also have to trust an adaptation team to maintain what's so wonderful about
yeah,
it, right?
Right.
And so, like, that's a lot, especially when it's a book that is as intense as The Sparrow and has provoked such strong responses in readers. As the, like, people don't like this book. People love this book.
It's like, it's not quite right to call it a cult classic, but it's also not far off either, right? Like, it captures something of the allegiance to, well, allegiance is too strong either, but the affection, the emotional and intellectual and almost spiritual investment in the reading of The Sparrow. For those of you who haven't read The Sparrow before, I'm going to read briefly the description. I think I don't know if they got this from somewhere else. This is in The Hollywood Reporter by Rick Porter. The Hollywood Reporter by Rick Porter. Anyway, there we are. Published in 1996, The Sparrow follows a group of Jesuit priests and scientists led by linguist Father Emilio Sandoz that makes the first contact with extraterrestrial life. The Vatican then backs a secret mission to a faraway planet in order to prove the existence of God throughout the universe. The mission ends in disaster, and Sandoz, the lone survivor, returns to Earth, a broken man, to face a Vatican inquiry into the now scandalous misadventure. If it sounds like a mashup of, like, Contact, The Da Vinci Code, and Arrival, there's a I mean, it's not that, but that's what it sounds like, and that's how strange of a book it is. A one of one in a lot of ways. The creative team, to me, is both interesting and... You'd like some women. You'd like some people of color involved in this.
Yeah.
But the individual projects, right? John Renick, who did Chernobyl, which I talked about on the show as being an unbelievable achievement. Also, the creative team that was involved in The Queen's Gambit, which a lot of people liked. I liked it fine. Also, Better Call Saul people and Logan and Out of Sight.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like an esteemed collection, but nothing there. I don't think I see any traps, but I don't see anything that give me, like, oh yeah, they're interested in updating this and bringing it to a contemporary sensibility. And because it's, you know, anytime you're with religion and the church, I mean, that's a minefield, Jen. Like, that's kind of what you're suggesting there in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I would like to see. I mean, I think it is. It should be a requirement for any production in the age that we are in that there is diversity in the writer's room in a lot of different ways. Because I think there's also, you know, there's potential ableism issues with this book. There's, you know, sex work portrayals. There's a lot of really rough, heavy stuff. There's trauma. There's abuse. There's xenophobia. There's, you know, like I said, some racial depictions. Like, there's a lot of really thorny. And then the religion aspect. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many. And that's why this book does provoke such a strong reaction, is because, you know, Russell is, I think, wrestling with these questions. I don't think there are easy answers in this book. I think there's a lot of questioning, and but to do that in a, you know, sensitive and thoughtful and non-exploitative way is the trick here. And when you're bringing something to, you know, something that has been like a text to visualizations, it's so easy to turn it into torture porn, for example, or to exploit the trauma in a way that is unhealthy and disrespectful of, you know, the survivors who have been through similar things. So it's kind of a minefield. Yes. I mean, it really kind of is. And since we know, like, there's not a lot of diversity in terms of, you know, our co-creator, showrunner situation, director, you know, who's going to be in that writer's room is a question I'm very curious about.
And I think the minefield is one allegory. The other one is like a gymnastics degree of difficulty. I think the degree of difficulty is extremely high. If pulled off well, could be an amazing phenomenon and a wonderful document, a cultural document, and that stands alongside Sparrow. If done poorly, it could be hitting your head on the balance beam as you fall to your bloody and ignominious end. Like, that's that. Those are kind of the poles, I think. I don't think there's a middle. Like, it was just fine. That's a weird.
No.
That weirdly is like the weird. That's like the least likely outcome to me. That was fine.
Right. Yeah, I think so. And like, we could get like a Watchmen level adaptation here, right? Like, it's a limited series, which I think is smart. I don't think you can make this into a movie effectively. I also don't think you should turn it into like season 10 of 10. You know, situation, right? Like, can you imagine? So I think a limited series is smart in terms of format, but again, like, you're biting off a lot, and like, how well are you going to be able to deliver, to mix my metaphors?
Yeah, it does make sense though that it's taken this long in this sort of new film genre for The Sparrow to even be approachable as a limited series, because it's not a movie. It's not.
No.
It's not. And it's also not an ongoing TV show, as you said. And you need some budget to make it look not cheesy.
Yes.
And there's a lot of things you need to do.
Yeah, there's aliens. Yeah. There's other planets. Like, there's space travel. There's all kinds of stuff that you're going to need an FX budget
That's
for.
That's right. So you need a lot of money. You need it to be adult. And you need it
yep.
to be, you know, 8 hours over eight episodes or something like that. And
right.
only now are we ready to have a market for that. So it makes sense
right.
to me in that regard.
Yeah, it's the age of prestige TV, right? And
right.
this is, if anything is a piece of prestige TV, it's this.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. Well, I'm glad we got to talk about that for a few minutes. We haven't yet talked in detail. Maybe I'll wait for Rebecca to come back. I don't think she ever read White Noise by Don DeLillo, or maybe she said she has been a million years. But that was the other one that we got, like,
mm-hmm.
within 10 minutes. Noah Baumbach making his first foray in adaptation with a non-problematic book at all called White Noise by Don DeLillo from 1986. We'll go 10 years back even further in a book that also feels relevant, could be relevant, mm-hmm. but also needs updating. 'Cause culturally, 1996 was about 100 years ago.
Right.
And 86 was 200 years ago, it feels like, to
yeah.
me at this point. Jen, thank you so much for stepping in for Rebecca this week. Hopefully, will we talk to you again before Dune is in theaters? You can email me at podcast@bookriot.com. Place your bets right now. As always, you can find show notes at bookriot.com/listen. I'm going to take votes for Rebecca versus my Swiss Army basket of picks until February 6th, right? I'm just making it up right now because not everyone's listening to it.
Is this your opportunity to shill for yourself when she's not on the air?
Well, let me just say right now that if it ended right now, I would be okay. But
okay.
I want to give people a chance to vote. You know how these things are with podcast downloads, Jen. At what
yes.
point is enough people listen to it that you've given people a fair shake, but it's also not 16 weeks from now when no one cares? Like, this is the problem.
2 weeks.
2 weeks.
My answer.
Well,
to
there
that
it
question.
Is. That's 2 weeks then. February 6th, the last
well,
day to
go.
Vote. You can explain if you want. I've enjoyed the explanations for people's votes, especially when you're voting for me. But Jen, they can vote for either Jeff or Rebecca. You can just put in the subject line. You can give me a little explanation. I don't care. You can find the lineups in the show notes to last week's episode podcast. At bookriot.com. Thanks, Jen. We'll talk to you next time.